Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of a Pen and a Napkin Podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to our interview series, episode number 225. And we're going across the pond. We're going across the Atlantic to downtown. Are we in downtown London? Where are we at, Alex?
I am. I'm kind of just east, but I'm very close to central. I'm in a place called Stratford where they had the Olympics, actually.
Gotcha.
In 2012.
Awesome. Awesome. Alex Sarama, basketball coach, author of the new book, Transforming Basketball. And Alex was kind enough to send me a copy of the book. I dove through it, and it probably took me about a week and a half to get through it. It was a lot of really, really good stuff, and just really excited to talk. He's got some new, I don't want to say new, but different ways of looking at the game, kind of bucking some traditions of the game, a lot of different resources that he used to write the book, and a lot of what we're going to talk about here on this podcast is going to be based on Alex's book. So, and we'll get to that, how to get a hold of it, how to buy it, all that other fun. We're going to pump you up here, Alex. We're going to try and get some book sales out there for you as well here. So, but before we get going with that, we want to thank our founding sponsor, Cosette Chiropractic, located at 144th and Maple here in Omaha. Coaches, if you or any of your athletes are struggling with balanced neck or spinal issues, go see Dr. Kevin or Dr. Heidi. Go to CosacChiro.com. Follow us on Twitter at a pen and a napkin. We try to put out daily coaching tidbits on the Twitter handle, so be sure to follow us there. If you're listening, whether you're in America, you're in England, you're in the UK, you're anywhere, you just download, rate, review, give us 5 stars, say nice things about a pen and a napkin podcast, so that when people look up coaching basketball podcast, Pen and a Napkin moves up the line there. Questions, comments, suggestions, or ideas, email me, apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Go check out apenandanapkin.com. It's a pretty good coach's website. It's pretty simple, pretty basic. As Alex just learned here the last few minutes, I'm not very good at technology sometimes. So it's pretty simple stuff, but it's got everything that you need. Alex, let's get going here. Let's give a chance for the folks that are unfamiliar with you, unfamiliar with your basketball journey. Tell us a little bit about your journey in the game, in England, in the UK. Basketball is growing slowly but surely. You know, you're facing that 64,000 pound monster in European football, but the game is growing. So tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the game and your basketball journey to this point.
Yeah, absolutely, Marty. Firstly, pleasure to be on the podcast. I love the concept. I'm all about, you know, conciseness. And I think I love the concept of just fitting, even just something as simple as fitting a philosophy on a napkin. It sounds silly, but it's something that's always resonated with me. And obviously, that's very synonymous with the name of the podcast. But essentially, I'm from the UK originally, as you alluded to. I actually haven't been here working for 7 years. So this is my first season in a long time being back, where I worked with a program called London Lions in the EuroCup. Mm-hmm. They are one of the better EuroCup teams now. They've got some pretty big time former NBA players like Sam Decker, Graham. So
yep,
that was a very unique opportunity. I think if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't have come back to the UK. But essentially, I started coaching very young. I just loved the game. And when I was 14, I had the chance to coach the younger age groups of my school, because it sounds crazy for the US listeners, but there literally weren't coaches or teachers who knew how to coach basketball at my school. So I had these unique opportunities afforded to me. When I was 21, I started an internship with the NBA league office internationally for Europe, Middle East, and Africa. And that was really where my kind of travel started, and I was able to develop some connections in the NBA world. It was during that period I came across research and the fact that we could coach in a very different way, informed by evidence and empirical research looking at how players can learn. So that was about 5-6 years ago now. And I went through all the research papers, read the books, and I just realized no one was applying it in basketball. And I made it my quest to learn it, apply it. And then when I figured that I knew enough of it to share with coaches, I would then begin doing that. And that's really what I've been doing the last few years. I've been coaching in Spain, Italy, Belgium, the US. I've traveled to 40 or more than 40 countries doing coaching clinics, player camps, and really sharing this alternative approach, which we're going to speak about on this podcast, all based on how players can learn more effectively.
Mm-hmm. So you're doing this research, your passport's getting a beating here, which is really cool. I'm slightly jealous a little bit. You decide to kind of take all of this and compact it in a book here. And the name of the book is Transforming Basketball. So what was your kind of inspiration for a guy your age, and you're just trying to get your, you know, you're trying to get your coaching career going, but then you're also taking the time to put together 350 pages or so of how to make this game better?
Yeah. So I think the best thing about the book, and one of the biggest motivations for me writing it, was I got a lot better in the process of being able to articulate these ideas. So I did the bulk of the writing when I was coaching in Italy. I had an academy there under players who were 16, 17, 18. And it was, we're a good level European kind of youth team. And it was a very useful environment, because I had afternoons where I'd be practicing and my mornings were completely free doing nothing as a professional coach. Okay. It was a tiny town, 15,000 people, Northern Italy, very quiet, very sleepy. So I really didn't have any distractions. And that was when I did the bulk of the book writing. And it was great because I was really just authentically talking about the things that I was learning about when I was reading the research papers. And then what I was actually doing on the court every single day in player development, team practices, in the weight room. And that was really what formed the basis of Transforming. And then kind of during my 3 years in Italy, there was some interest in NBA circles just through the stuff I was sharing online. So had a lot of conversations with NBA coaches, front office personnel about what this approach looks like. I spent a year actually as an assistant coach of Paris basketball in the Euro Cup. I combined that with my role in Italy in a remote role. It was very unusual. Mm-hmm. Worked with an awesome head coach called Will Weaver, who's all in on an evidence-based approach, and figured out, you know, how you can apply these ideas with pros. And then I was doing it anyway at the youth level. So that was the whole process. And this past season, I should have mentioned, Marty, I've been split between working in Portland with the Trailblazers, mm-hmm. and their G League affiliate, and the London Lions. So okay. I've had this huge mix of coaching everything from beginners to NBA. And I think that's really helped me not just become a more effective coach, but also articulate how these ideas are applied at every level of basketball.
And that's one of the things that I wanted to see, because, you know, you could talk about and hear my friend Mark Kruger's favorite line lately. You know, we have like championship productions here in the States and different things like that. And it's great watching Gino Auriemma doing his thing at UConn. But, you know, as I've said for a long time, he's got 12 kids that are McDonald's All-Americans. Most of us have 12 kids that eat at McDonald's, you know. So how can we take these theories and put them in practice? And it's geared towards your pros, your Scoot Hendersons and DeAndre Ayton's with your Portland Trailblazers in your situation, you know, or your Sam Deckers and that type of thing. But most of us are coaching kids that are not in that level. So that was one of the things I was curious about. And I think that the hypothesis of the book, and correct me if I'm wrong with any of this, Alex, but you kind of want to, and I had to go through some words that I hadn't read in a long time. My Briarcliff University education here out of Sioux City, Iowa, was tested a little bit with some of your research stuff. But basically, the hypothesis that you're busting up is we've always done it that way. You know, you ask it, you know,
yes.
You know, here's the drill. Why do we do that? Well, we've always done it that way. We've always done this drill, that drill, the Alex drill, the Marty drill. We've always done that drill. We've always done it that way. It's the way that it's been happening for 75 or 100 years. And I, you know, so you called it path dependency, you know, where we're kind of clearing everything out of the way And, you know, it's the way that I've done it when I was coached. And I think there are those influences, but kind of expand on that. And am I right? Am I wrong? That was kind of one of the things
you
I picked up
are.
Picked up
yeah.
early on in the
you
in the book.
Absolutely are, Marty. Yeah. So I mentioned that in the opening chapter, and essentially path dependency, it comes from a professor, John McWhorter from Columbia. And it's the idea that in modern life, there are a lot of things we do in multiple fields which don't make sense. And really the only reason we do them is because it's always been done that way. In other words, the status quo. So really what I'm trying to do with the book is just get coaches thinking differently and asking the question, you know, why do I coach this way? Am I coaching this way just because it's how I was coached as a player? It's what I saw celebrity coaches doing when I first got into the profession. And I think in every kind of part of human life, we see a lot of advancements, whether it's technology, medicine, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it is.
Yep.
And I think in basketball coaching, it should be the same. And the reality is a lot of the concepts, drills, philosophies that we're using right now in 2024, I'd say are very similar, if identical, maybe to 50 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And some things don't have to change. I can guarantee you there would be some good small-sided games that like coaches like Bobby Knight would have done decades ago. But we should be looking at how we can make improvements continuously and just advance the coaching profession. And that's really the whole idea, kind of showing coaches why some path-dependent ideas that we've done held on to for a long time in basketball just don't make much sense in light of the research that we now have. And then practically what that means to how coaches are running their practices, whether it's high school, beginners, college, whatever.
Mm-hmm. So some of the sacred cows of coaching basketball that you kind of, you know, said, hey, this, why are we doing this? We shouldn't be doing this. Yeah. And I love the arguments that you gave for it, but the mic and drill, practicing against air, you know, pattern, you know, cones and chairs, you know, coming off of cones, coming off of chairs, you know, drills like two ball dribbling and that type of thing. You know, where's kind of the argument or why are you saying that some, again, like these are kind of the sacred cows of coaching basketball, and you're kind of saying with your hypothesis, hey, we're wasting our time. This is not really applicable.
Absolutely. So I'd say the essence of kind of, and the underpinning of this is understanding how basketball players actually move mm-hmm. and what motor learning, what motor behavior is. That's basically just how we move as human beings. And how we move is not through the process that we've long assumed it to be as basketball coaches, which would be things like muscle memory mm-hmm. or the idea that we've got to perfect a technique to basically acquire a skill, own it, and then bring it out at the right time. So how we actually move is a different process. And that's kind of what I spend the first three chapters really getting into. And it's, I have to do that because without sharing that theory, there's no basis for working differently,
mm-hmm.
right? It could just be my opinion. And I think it's really important that coaches see it's not my opinion, but it's research.
It's the science behind it.
Exactly. Yeah. So for simple terms, just for coaches listening to this, how we move as human beings, it's a process called perception-action coupling. So we're seeing and doing. And as we're seeing things within our world on the basketball court, whether it's opponents, defenders, etc., we're moving. And as we move, we take in more information. And essentially what happens is skills are always emerging. So within a context, they're emerging and they're going to look different every time because the environment is always different. The location of the defense, how they're positioned in relation to the offense, teammates, fatigue, all of these things.
So, all the different variables that go into it.
The different, exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. And I call these things constraints. So it's, we know that that's what determines whether basketball players are successful or not in the game. So to make them more skilled, we've got to recreate these variables. And if we know that players don't get better by rehearsing these techniques over and over again, just how can we do it in a way where things are going to transfer more effectively to the game? And the best example on the mic and Marty would be the level of challenge. It's just, it's not optimal enough to shape learning, because it's, even if a player made 7 out of 10 wide open, it's still not going to be that beneficial. All we have to do is just take the mic and just change it with some constraints, just add some type of opponent where the opponent is kind of shaping how they finish. Mm-hmm. So instead of doing, you know, those identical hook shots every time, they're going to have to finish in a slightly different way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be really optimal. And, you know, coaches don't have to throw everything out of the pram. All they've got to do, they can take the same drills they've been using and just find ways to tweak them, add some more variability, add a defender, and boom, your drills now are going to be really effective.
Mm. Coaches, it is official. October 12th and 13th, Saturday and Sunday, October 12th and 13th, 2024, will be our first annual A Pen and a Napkin Coaches Retreat. It is going to be over 24 hours of just basketball coaching and getting yourself primed and ready for the upcoming season. We're going to do a lot of different things. Coach Flannery and the staff at Creighton University have been gracious enough to allow us to come in and watch them practice that day. We're going to have roundtable sessions with coaches that you're attending the clinic with, which is one of the best aspects of any A Pen and a Napkin event. We're going to have a full timeout situation score group discussion with the coaches that are attending, as well as coaches social, and then, of course, guest speakers. We got some great coaches lined up right now. We're probably going to be adding a couple of more here. It is going to be a great, great weekend here in Omaha. We'll be staying at the Holiday Inn Express at 87th and West Dodge Road here in Omaha, and it is really, really affordable. $200 for the weekend, and that includes food, that includes your lodging at the hotel, drinks, everything that goes into it. It is going to be included in that $200 for well over 24 hours worth of activities. If you're a commuter, if you're living in the Omaha area and you want to join in, but you don't want to stay at the hotel, it's $125. Think of that. That's literally, what, $5-6 an hour for an entire weekend of becoming a better coach. So coaches, I encourage you to sign up as soon as you can for the first annual A Pen and a Napkin Fall Coaches Retreat. So let's, and I don't want to get too far into it because we got a lot to talk about here. So,
yeah,
you know, you're saying, like, again, Mikan's easy for 99.9% of the people listening to this to understand, you know. So the old Mikan, that type of thing, instead of just having Alex doing the Mikan drill, let's have Alex do the Mikan drill with a teammate walled up on him.
Exactly.
And yes. Have them to go over that. That's it. Or, you know, some of the things that I did when I coached was, all right, mic and drill, but you've got to make 5 in a row without the ball hitting the ball can't hit the rim. You just can't make it.
True.
The ball can't hit the rim. It's got to be a perfect make or things like that. And that's kind of what we'll eventually be talking about down the line here, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I love applying that constraint with that defender walling up. I've actually done the exact same thing, Marty, where it's like, okay, you can only score Swish or Brad back rim and down, like mm-hmm. within, you know, under the basket. You got a defender just there because it's not a drastic change, is it? Just having a person standing here.
Yeah.
But it impacts everything from the learning process and skill acquisition because they're going to have to find a different way to finish every time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just finding ways where we can tweak these activities just like how you described.
Sure. So Mikan's, cones and chairs, that type of stuff, that's out. Some of the stuff that you put in there, and one of the chapters I really enjoyed was, and I forget what number chapter it was, Alex, but you go through you go through different drills. Like, I'm not just telling you
mm-hmm.
this is out, but you also, you know, here's the solution. Here's some things that you can do, and here's how you can apply it at every level. So some things like dribble tag, small-sided game with constraints, conceptual offense. And we're going to get into, like, conceptual offense versus pattern offense later on here in a little, as we go through it here. But the great thing about the book is you're not just pointing out the problem. You're giving the solutions as well. And that's what I really liked about it.
Yeah. That's it, Marty. I wanted to be very intentional with it because I think – it's no good, in my opinion anyway, to respectfully challenge something.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say, I'm never challenging or critiquing coaches who use these ideas, because guess what? I used to do all of this. Mm-hmm. And it was only 6 years ago that I was doing this stuff. But I'm challenging the concept and the philosophy, right? Not the coaches who use those ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think you can challenge something without offering the alternative. And that's where, throughout the whole book, wherever I have challenged something, like you said, I've provided a practical alternative to how you can do it through this, I call it the contemporary approach. So how you can move away from the dominant approach and use a contemporary approach to get the same outcome, but in a more effective manner.
Gotcha. One of the things I found interesting, and I've heard this before, and it's been kind of an American thing as well. You talk a lot about jazz music in the book as well. There's a lot of comparisons between basketball and jazz. Explain that.
So jazz music's had a big influence. On me, Marty. I played saxophone growing up,
mm-hmm.
and I always like using analogies and metaphors to try to help coaches make more sense of these ideas. And that's where I find like drawing on things in other fields can be useful sometimes. And I think a few examples I used in the book was, number one, with jazz musicians, it's really funny when you compare them to classical musicians, because we know classical musicians find it difficult to go off script when they're in any environment that is not a classical orchestra, because they're so well trained to deliberately follow the music, read it, and do it. Whereas jazz musicians are often a lot more adaptive. And I use the example of Miles Davis, who pioneered with so many, who tried so many different musical genres throughout his career. And as times and society changed and musical interests were different, he was actually able to play different types of jazz and even completely different genres, because he was just a skilled, adaptive musician. And when I was growing up, something that happened a lot was my music teachers would say, well, you've got to play the scales first before we go on to playing the songs and improvising. And that to me is kind of the perfect equivalent of the fundamentals. And this idea that we have to have these fundamental movements in place before we can do more advanced things. And the whole idea that I talk about instead is we want functional over fundamental. So I'm obsessed with developing skilled players, and this doesn't mean that I'm just going to let anything happen and I'm just going to let players just do random games.
Mm.
Definitely not. But I want players, I'm more interested in developing a player who can pass as many different ways as possible versus doing the one chest pass over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, the best way to develop that functionality would be constraining defenders and constraining small-sided games so that players can do this pass in loads of different situations and then become more skillful in the process as they do that.
Yeah, because I think one of the when you make that comparison, I love the comparison. And I think the one pushback that you would get to everything that you've got outlined to the book, and I'll be honest with you, me a little bit, you know, shouldn't you master the scales to a degree,
yes,
to make your improvisation that much better? I think that would be when you're making that comparison, I think that's the one area of pushback that I think you've probably heard from I don't want to say old school coaches, but coaches who are, you know, kind of the doubting Thomas, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's funny, I actually did a whole chapter on it, providing the alternatives. But I didn't get the space, so I had to shelve it for the part two of the book.
Shameless plug, but that's okay. we're going to get to that in part two, absolutely. Go ahead, Alex.
Love it. Sorry. So, I mean, I'd say essentially on that, that was my biggest hurdle when I actually first came across these ideas. And I actually really couldn't get over it for at least a year or two, that you didn't need to do these things. And what I ended up doing was kind of like small-sided games, but a lot of the time trying to teach things first and then put it into a small-sided game where it was more live, they're making decisions. And I think just the more I became comfortable with the research and I understood how I could create environments where these skills would emerge effectively, then that's when I could move away from having to teach the techniques. I think at the start, I wasn't able to do that because I wasn't using constraints well, which led to these, you know, a variety of skills working a functional way for each player. So, and I think that's completely normal, Marty, for coaches. And I think it's, I wouldn't expect a coach to just suddenly read the book and be like, yeah, I'm going to go all in. If that, you know, I know that's happening for some coaches, and that's great. I'm delighted to hear that. But all I want with the book is maybe for coaches to move, and in, even if in 25% of their practices they do more live activities using small-sided games, that's a huge win.
Yeah.
And then I think what will happen is the more coaches continue to think about it, reflect, then maybe in a year later they move from 25 to 50%. Mm-hmm. And it's their journey, you know, and it's I'm not the one to impose something on a coach and say, you must do this. It's, they should be comfortable with it. And I think the more they, you know, just contemplate on some of the things in the book over the you know, their coaching journey, they might be able to gravitate towards the constraints that approach more.
I think that's interesting. You kind of, even with all these theories that came out at the beginning, you were even kind of fighting it in your own head a little bit.
Yeah, that's so that, exactly. So this would have been, I remember it was 6 years ago when I first read it, and I came across CLA, Ecological Dynamics. Mm-hmm. And the biggest reason why was because there was nothing at the time in basketball showing actually how to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's why I started transforming basketball. Because I think when coaches can see the videos of how to do it, it's like, ah, the light bulbs go off.
Mm-hmm.
But when you haven't got that comparison or something to look at, it's very challenging. Because like, I remember I just didn't know better. And I was just holding on to the ideas I had at the time of everything I'd done for, I guess, like 10 years of my coaching career. So it's, and that's where in that activities chapter, the videos, you know, on the YouTube channel where coaches can actually see it. I think that's where they can then apply their unique, rich, practical experiences and make the activities even better.
Mm-hmm. You kind of describe, like, the thing that popped into my head when you were talking about making different passes at different angles and just kind of letting, you know, it's kind of the I'm seasoned and experienced enough, Alex, to remember guys like Jamal Wilkes and even Larry Bird or Magic Johnson, you know, where their jump shots were jump shots that were developed on the playgrounds. There's no trainers. There's, you know, part of the sin, if you will, that we have today in our coaching world, it's a blessing, but it's a curse, is we kind of have that overcoaching to a degree, whether it's trainers, it's film, it's analytics, it's all these other things. And you're talking a lot about playing on feel, and not everything has to be so robotic, and you're making those adjustments for the variables that are in front of them and different things like that. But at the same time, we don't allow our players to just go like me and my friends did back in the 80s, and you just play pickup in somebody's driveway for 2 or 3 hours, or you go and meet at this place and you're playing 5-on-5 pickup and that type of thing, and having that feel and that type of thing. Is that part of kind of what we, to a degree, maybe need to get back to a little bit more?
100% it is, Marty. And I think I'd say this, you know, I cannot imagine Larry Bird working out with a skills trainer. It would not have happened, right? I see you laughing.
Only if the trainer funny. Would have bought him like a 12-pack of Budweiser, then he might have done it, you know? So.
There you go. But it's like, it's funny but sad at the same time, because think about the proportion of players now at the highest level who have a trainer, and even youth kids, the number of youth kids who have a trainer. And you could get away with drills even 20 years ago, because what were kids doing? They were playing pickup, playing more in the parks, playing with friends outdoors. So you could do all of that. But nowadays, that doesn't exist. And kids are working out with trainers at the cost of doing all those things. So this, to me, is why coaches in their practices, it's even more important that they actually create these alive environments where players are making decisions playing, because the kids are not getting it anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what a shift towards the CLA and the ideas we're using at transforming, especially in America and the US, I think would really improve youth basketball and make more skillful players, because we're countering that tide of AAU and skills trainers.
Yeah. A Pen and a Napkin University videos are just another way that A Pen and a Napkin can help you become a better coach. Our university video library is constantly expanding, with topics ranging from interviewing for a job to full court defense to 25 universal truths about coaching. Our university videos will help you round out your skill set as a coach and help you hone your craft. Videos are $10 a piece, with bundling options available. To order, you can DM me on Twitter, send me an email at apenandanapkin@gmail.com, or order from our website, apenandanapkin.com. Be sure to check out the A Pen and a Napkin video library. You got 1 foot on either side of the pond here. How much do you know, is there a big difference between kids in Europe and the trainer model compared to the U.S.? Kind of fill us in on that a little bit.
Yeah, huge difference. So it's really funny because I'd say a lot of U.S. coaches think that it's the coaching in Europe that the accounts for why the players are so skilled and why we have so many European players in the NBA.
Yep.
And I don't want to say we don't have great coaches, because I think we do, actually. And I think the level of like specificity is what's different between the normal European and U.S. coach, especially at the pro level. Mm-hmm. But I actually think the biggest difference is it's the social cultural constraints. So I'll build on that a little bit. Like, and a huge one is in youth basketball in Europe, under 12s, you would not see basketball played if on a full size hoop with an adult ball. It just mm-hmm. wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
Because every federation in Europe knows that that's poor practice.
Yeah.
So we have 8 foot hoops, size 5 balls. So what happens is the kids from a very young age in Europe can actually do pretty advanced skills because it's suited to their growth, their action capabilities, etc. Whereas in the US we don't see that, right? And then I think what happens too is we have a club model here. So it's got its positives and its negatives. But the positive is that kids just don't work with trainers, or we have some trainers here, but it's like minimal compared to the US. Minimal. Mm-hmm. It's not a business model.
Correct.
And so kids develop in their clubs, and what that often means is they're having, you know, their practices, and they're more focused on playing as a team and learning team basketball, as opposed to what I see a lot of now in the US, which I'm concerned about, is it's more of an individualistic approach. Mm-hmm. And I think it's difficult for high school coaches because they have to try and combat that in season. But AAU and the skills trainer develops, in my opinion, a false impression of basketball, because it's developing players who don't know things like spacing, how to work as a team, how to create an advantage, how to read a pick and roll, an off-ball screen. And for me, I think the number of players, even in the NBA, who can just go one-on-one, green light every time, maybe, what, it's 10 players in the world who have the green light to do that. Everyone else is having to play out of triggers, spacing, taking good shots.
Yep.
And it's very difficult because, you know, players get to the NBA and that's like the first time really they're hearing these things, unless they were doing it in high school or whatever.
Yeah. It's so kind of like the American model. We have the high school coach, but then the kids have their AAU coach, and then typical high school roster. You have 14 kids on your high school roster who might be playing for 14 different AAU teams, and they all have 14 different trainers. Whereas in Europe, it's one team. These 14 guys are together with the same coaching staff, and they're being taught the same things consistently, and the message is much more consistent.
Yes.
Instead of getting things from 3, 4, 5, you know, you extrapolate. And I teach history, Alex, not math, so I can't do the math on 14 times 14 times 14. But do you get where I'm going with that? Is that what you kind of see?
Yeah, that's it.
Yep. Okay.
Absolutely it is. And the biggest advantage – oh, sorry.
No, keep going.
Yeah, keep going. So the biggest – real quick, it's just like with the clubs, you have under 12, under 14, under 16, under 18, and then often a pro team. So the kids learn just by watching the pros because there's that kind of club feel. But then you often have – like what I did at London Lions was we had a club vision in every age group. So we had the exact same language, the same style of play. So it was a seamless thing above the age group. So kids didn't have to relearn a completely different offense or defense every season. It just seamlessly would integrate as they moved up the club. And I think that's a huge advantage of a good club model.
I'm ready to move to England.
Well, I think not many teams doing it. And even in Europe, it's rare. But I think more teams now are following what we're doing at transforming. More clubs are doing that and adopting it. And in high school, I've had a lot of conversations with coaches doing it where they're trying to now do this with like middle school JV varsity and get that seamless blend, which is great.
Page 122. Let's get into it. Kind of the biggest theme, you go through the first three chapters kind of explaining the science of it and the all of that. But on page 122, for the first time, you refer to the CLA, the constraints-led approach. I'm just going to let you cook, Alex. Just talk to us about it and what does it all mean? And when I got to this point, man, this is when it really started singing to me. So talk to us, hear about it.
Excellent. Love it, Marty. So I'll say this. A key part of the constraints-led approach, CLA, I'll call it from now on quicker, is using small-sided games. And this is nothing new because coaches have been using small-sided games for many decades before I was born. But it's not the CLA. So within the CLA, basically, it's using activities that are small-sided games and defenders. But what makes them different is that we're using constraints very specifically. So instead of playing the exact same small-sided game in practice every time, we might use one constraint that changes everything. And I'll give some examples now, Marty. So it could be we're playing a one-on-one. Well, if we just roll the balls out and say, "All right, kids, go play one-on-one." It's probably not going to be that effective because the players can just rely on similar movements and skills that they've always done. So what we can do is we can use constraints to get them moving in different ways so new skills will emerge. So for instance, we can say, "All right, it's one-on-one, but you have a 4-second shot clock. One-on-one, you can only score from the rim inside the charge circle or deep paint and three. All right, you can only play inside the lane lines. So you've got that narrow kind of strip to play in. Okay, it's one-on-one. You've got three dribbles and you've got to score a gold medal shot. That's a score like right under the rim. So I'm giving very basic constraint ideas here, but then you could say, all right, you're changing the location every time of your one-on-one. You're going to catch low post, mid-range three, always variable. Now we're going to add a second defender who's stunting or acting as a help defender. So the idea is that every couple minutes, every few minutes, based on what we're seeing and what problems emerge or what we need to help the players find, we can think of a constraint to help solve that. So the CLA is basically creating these very specific learning environments. And I think a very important part of doing it is we're not just doing random small-sided games just to play a game, but maybe there's an offensive philosophy that a coach has where we use these constraints to develop that philosophy through these small-sided games.
Yeah, and you can do it both sides on the ball as well, not just offensively, but defensively as
Yeah,
well.
that's the
Like,
biggest advantage.
you know, like for my
Yeah.
team, I really evolved into a no middle coach. So we, you know, like you're talking about
Awesome.
your constraint stuff. So, hey, we're gonna go, we did a, it, this is my language I'm speaking here. We're going to do chop drill, close
Sounds good.
out, offense, you get two dribbles to score. Defense or but offense, if you get to the lane, you win. Even if you don't score, you win. If you get a if you get a
That's
if,
it.
if you get to the middle,
Yes.
you know,
Immediate consequence.
the
That's it.
you know, that type of a thing. So
That's it, Marty.
those are the things that we're talking about here with this constraints-led approach here.
Yes.
Yep.
That's it. And the best thing about it, Marty, is that no middle example you that no middle constraint you just gave is the best example of it. Because it's not just how we traditionally thought is that we need different drills to our practice and each drill will solve a particular problem. Instead, it should be a cumulative effect. Whereas that no middle constraint that you just said, it could apply, maybe you're trying to really get that home, drive that home. Well, maybe it applies in every small-sided game of the practice. So then whatever it is, the intention is there. And that's where when they use this approach well, you can have these constraints in regards to the activity, the same constraints in multiple different small-sided games, and that's where you see the biggest difference, because they just learn so much more. And what would maybe traditionally take 20 practices, well, guess what? One or two practices, it's going to be there, and the players will start showing it.
Yep. I thought one of the great quotes that I liked around this point of the book: in order to develop an elevated basketball IQ, you need to have opportunities to improve on it. Which I love that, because at some point you just got to throw them out there and let them go, and you got to kind of figure it out. As a legendary coach here in the States, Don Meyer, figure it out. And sometimes you just got to throw them out there and you got to say, okay, hey, here's the constraints, but you got to figure it out. And in order to make that IQ grow, that playground IQ grow, that you know, players up until the last 20 years or so, you honed your craft on the asphalt or whatever. But you got to relinquish some of that control as a coach to allow those things to happen. Expand on that.
Yeah. So, I love that you brought up that Don Meyer quote. And coaches often say, well, what would the legends of basketball have thought of this? Well, and I'd say two things to that. One, I think they did a lot of CLA elements unintentionally.
Yep.
And I think they would actually be curious about this, because the research didn't exist when they were coaching. Mm-hmm. A lot of the ecological dynamics research has been in the 2000s and more the last 10 years. So I think the best coaches that we've seen in the game have been the most intellectually curious. And I think they would have been really curious to learn about this, and it would have made them intentionally aware of some of the good things they were actually doing in practice. Mm-hmm. But on that IQ note, I think what I often talk about with coaches is developing more conceptual offense styles, where it's not just kind of one fixed pattern that the players have to do every time. Now, I'm not saying not to use set plays, because I use set plays and I think there's a time and place for them, but it's more players understanding that, you know, it could be one action, I call it a trigger, like a pick and roll, and players you're developing the IQ so that they can create an advantage to punish any defensive coverage they see in that pick and roll. And guess what? If they do that, well, the sets are going to be way better. And obviously, to develop that IQ, you've got to start somewhere, because a lot of coaches will kind of say, well, I can't do conceptual offense and start doing it because my players have no IQ. But it's kind of like a double-edged sword, because if you're not starting and giving them opportunities to do that, well, you're never going to be able to try it out.
Mm-hmm. And that's where I really turned a corner in my own career, where we went away from kind of the pattern stuff to the more motion-based and conceptual stuff. So
awesome.
That's for part two. I'm going to hold your horses on that one here, Coach. So,
okay.
And you're talking about the old school guys, you know, Bobby Knight. Once, and this was something that always stuck in my head. Bobby Knight once said, you know, I want to work on both off. If I've got 120 minutes of practice, I want to work on offense and defense for 120 minutes. And the CLA type of stuff gives you a better opportunity to do that.
Yes. That's exactly it. Two-way coaching. You get both at the same time, and you can have something I love, which I don't think I actually mentioned in the book, was having two ways to win a small-sided game.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really simple constraint. But instead of just, because what often happens is when we say, all right, we're playing to 12 points or whatever it is, what naturally happens is the players, unless the coach is really bringing out the defense and reminding them about it, they naturally gravitate towards an offensive focus. But you could say, all right, you win by getting 12 points or three stops, whatever comes first.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great constraint that makes sure that the defense is always intense, and then the offense has to rise to meet that good defense. And just another good example of how the CLA could be used in any small-sided game.
Absolutely. Coaches are absolutely loving our Taking Over a New Program booklet. As many of you know, I spent 2 years outside of coaching, and during that time, I hung a note card in my workspace at school that said, "Strip the house down to the studs." I took that time to really rethink and reorganize my thoughts on what it takes to run a transformational program. As I prepared for the possibility of coaching again, I organized these thoughts into this 96-page booklet. How much do I trust this booklet? I used this booklet as I went on interviews to help sell myself and my vision for what my new program would look like. If I'm using it to sell myself, why wouldn't I recommend it to you, my listeners? This booklet will help you look at any part of your program, no matter what stage you're at in your program, and help improve it in some way. It's all yours for only $15, which includes shipping and handling. For more information, email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com. So what do you think about the coach who says, and you kind of talked about it a little bit earlier, is it practical to take kind of some of the old school, I still want to work on my scales, I want to still do my ball handling around chairs and cones and work on those type of things, but also have the CLA approach part to that too. In the book, you kind of advocate for kind of just jumping in with 2 feet and letting it rip. What do you say to the coach that says, yeah, Alex, I kind of see what you're saying, but I'm still having a hard time letting go of the other stuff here. And I still think it's important that we hit the cones and we hit the chairs or
absolutely
that type of thing. What's your response to that?
It's totally cool because coaches have to be comfortable. And I think they would benefit more going all in on CLA. They're going to benefit a lot more just trying it, even if they use it 50% of the time versus not doing it at all. And I'd rather they do that than just staying entirely on drills and doing a few random small-sided games. So coaches have to start somewhere. And that's where I was when I started with all of this, you know, earlier on in my career. So I think it's if coaches really see a value in that stuff, fine. But I would say think about how you could get the same outcomes to emerge to a CLA activity. And this is the big thing. It doesn't always have to be a live defender. So for instance, say a coach really wants a crossover move. You could literally just have a defender passively standing on the three-point line, and the offensive player must dribble in front, cross the ball over, but the defender tries to steal the ball without moving.
Mm-hmm.
That's an example of the CLA. So we get the same outcome with that crossover, but we're constraining it heavily, but that's okay because the way they cross it over is going to be slightly different every time. The mm-hmm. height, where they have to see the defender and avoid it. And then maybe yep. as they finish, the defender's just there being big. So mm-hmm. it's not live, but to me, that's the easy alternative to doing a drill where it is just repetitive 1-on-0 over and over again. Just make it slightly different and you'll see a huge advantage.
Awesome. Here's my copy of the book, Alex. Right here, you can see it all the way from London to Omaha.
Great.
There we go. We got some highlights in it and everything. So if folks want to get Transforming Basketball by Alex Sarama, where do they find it? How do they get it, my friend?
Absolutely. So easiest place is just go Amazon.com and just put in Transforming Basketball book, and you'll see it come up first search. We got it as Kindle and a print copy. I do recommend the print copy, and I love how you highlighted it, Marty, and that's something I'd say to coaches. I think the print copy, it's just nicer visually, and mm-hmm. you can make notes and all of that stuff.
Yep, yep. If folks want to know more about you, Alex, how do they find out about you?
Absolutely. So our website, transformingbball.com, is the best starting point. And then I'd say just finding us on social media. So it's just Transform B-Ball or on Instagram and Transforming B-Ball on Twitter, on X.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Folks, if you like part one, guess what? We're not done. We got a part two coming here. Coach has got to go grab a call here. I'm going to do a heck of a lot better job of getting the Zoom set up the second time around here in a little bit. So, but we got a lot more to talk about. I don't even know if we're halfway through the book yet that we've talked about here. So, this is going to be dropping one day. I'm going to tease you with it. It's going to be the anticipation of part one, and then you're gonna have to wait 24 hours to hear part two. But Alex and I are gonna be back with part two here. And Coach, go ahead and take care of your call here. Hold on just a second here, but that's what we got here. So Transforming Basketball, Alex Sarama. Hope you've enjoyed part one. Tune in tomorrow for part two. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time. Awesome, Alex. So,
great stuff, Martin. That was great.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Why don't we say 25 mins? Because I've got that gives me time to quickly eat and get this call done. Let me just check.
So,
this.
It's 7:05 there. Cool? It's 7:05 there,
yeah,
right?
It's 7:05.
I'll set up the Zoom for 7:45. I'll give you 40 minutes. I give you plenty of time.
That's great.
So,
that's great. That's
so easier. Hopefully I don't goof it up as badly as I did last time.
No problem.
All right.
No problem.
We'll see you in about
40 minutes.
Perfect. Thanks,
right.
Alex.
Thanks, Marty.
Yep, bye-bye.
Right.